Well, I'm happy to report that our technical difficulties have been resolved. I'm happy to report that our technical difficulties in Miami have been resolved. And we have Suzanne Martin, who is ready to join us in costume, in referee mode.
Hello.
Hello, Suzanne.
Greetings from Miami. Sorry I couldn't be there with you today. We had a little bit of a technical issue, so I couldn't get into the meeting. So sorry, Kathy, that I wasn't able to introduce you as well, be there in person. But I do want to promote a raffle for the Bash here from Miami. I'm here actually doing a sales kickoff with my America's team with about 500 salespeople in between Pro Bowl and Super Bowl. So, of course, we themed it NFL, and as Motorola is a sponsor of the NFL, has a lot of activities down here. Preview, when you watch the Super Bowl this weekend, look out for our ad. We're going to have a really great ad. So this is the raffle prize, which you may have heard a little bit about. This is an NFL football. There's the proof right there. You can see that, right? This football is signed by DeMarcus Ware from the Cowboys, Mike Singletary from Chicago Bears, Devin Hester from the Chicago Bears, and Santonio Holmes, MVP from the Pittsburgh Steelers from a couple years ago, Super Bowl. So pretty good football to have, and I think that a raffle prize here, I think it's one ticket for $5 or five for 20, so get them while you can. And I'll bring this football home for you from Miami. So see you next month, and have a good day.
Thank you, Suzanne. So through the lunch, I think you can still buy your raffle tickets. So today we have the great privilege of welcoming Kathy Button-Bell as our keynote speaker. As the CMO of Emerson, Kathy leads the global marketing and corporate branding initiatives of this $20 billion global company, which many of us are familiar as a leader in the technology and the engineering industries. Since joining Emerson in 1999, Kathy has been an agent of change and transformation. Her first area of focus was to develop and launch a new brand architecture and brand strategy that could encompass the company's 60-plus divisions. And Kathy presented some of that to us in 2004, 2005, and some of the ad campaigns that they delivered as part of that. In 2009, they extended and expanded that same brand strategy with a new campaign with a theme called It's Never Been Done Before. And having dinner with Kathy last night, remembering, knowing a little bit about her career, her presentation a few years ago, it seems to me in some regards that the company's theme can also be applied to Kathy. She is a marketer who does things that haven't been done before. Within the B2B marketing community, she's heralded as one of our rock stars. Most importantly, the success of her work is reflected in the company's success, both financially and in terms of the company's reputation. So I hope you are ready for a great presentation. It was a rock and roll dinner conversation last night. Please join me in welcoming Kathy Button-Bell to BMA Chicago.
Thank you. That's very sweet. Well, I'm sorry you couldn't all have been there for dinner last night because it was rollicking, and I did promise I'll work Lady Gaga into this somewhere for everybody. And all roads lead to Lady Gaga right now, don't you think, anyway? So it makes a difference. But that was a terribly nice introduction. And, you know, when I talk to business school students, one of the primary things I always try to get across when I think they all want to be the brand manager on Nike sneakers or something like that, and I always say, you have no idea the joy and the excitement of working in the industrial marketplace. And aside from the intellectual companionship of all the people that are in this room and where I work, I always say the greatest golden handcuffs are the people you sit next to. And I think we live in a very interesting space in the economy, a very interesting space in business of really inventing, you know, what we're still doing. I think a lot of things haven't been done yet before in industrial marketing. A lot of things haven't been done in our businesses. And I think we're facing, my joke about the BMA is always that it's like therapy when we all have dinner together because we all have the same problems. We face a lot of the same challenges, whether it's trying to get bigger budgets or just trying to fight for attention in a space that's sometimes either overlooked by the outside world You know, we compete very hard against consumer brands for attention, certainly in the financial markets. So I appreciate having such a big therapy session today. It's maybe not as much fun as Hattiesburg, Mississippi, but we'll make this work for everybody here. So let's see if we don't share a lot of these problems, and I hope you have lots of questions afterwards. So I'll start with a little grounding on Emerson for those of you who either didn't see me talk before or don't know too much about us, which is this is kind of our little timeline for the last 10 years, what we did. And like a lot of industrial companies, I think we had never done anything about marketing before, and no one had ever been chief marketing officer of Emerson. And actually, chief marketing officer in about 1999 was still kind of a new name or a new position for companies. And so a lot of like groundwork had to be done. We did a lot of research. We had to define and refine who Emerson was. We had to architect it. We had, as she said, we had 60 companies. That's like 860 pieces that go to that. We literally have 680 websites right now we're trying to migrate. So it gives you a feeling of pieces, lots of pieces of business. So we had to sort of actively start to promote a bigger brand for Emerson, which we've done over the last 10 years. And then we started to what I would call arrive. And Dave Farr, who you see in the picture there, is our CEO, who took over the exact same time as I got my job and we launched our branding. Really done a great job sort of being holding the mantle of this up. Many of you may be aware of who Chuck Knight was, who is our CEO, really kind of a big trophy, I would call trophy CEO, tall in the saddle, traditional, real hard-driving and successful. I think it would have been harder for him to carry a new brand forward than a new CEO. He actually had the permission to say, something's broken, I'd like you to fix it, and then hand it to Dave and say, now you drive it, because I think it fit both their personalities and fit the company better. He likes to say arriving happens at $20 billion. He thought that was the threshold for relevance in the business market. And all of a sudden, if our earnings are in the Wall Street Journal or something, we did an acquisition, all of a sudden the picture in the Wall Street Journal is a little bigger. All of a sudden, people actually bother to put us in a headline. You know, I worked in the footwear industry years ago, and my goal used to be to get Converse in the same sentence with Reebok and Nike. You know, so you try to just get relevant enough for people, and then I think it's where we are now, which is on this differentiating. And, you know, I feel like when you buy dioramas at the airport, you're putting yourself in the category with Accenture on one side, and I do have envy of your touchscreen thing. I go by that every day, and I just pray at the altar of airport advertising when I see it. I just love that big map. I just like to play with it. So I just wanted to say Emerson on top. But it's so funny because right now we are trying to decide, who are you? You know, how do you put personality in a brand, in a company, and pull it apart from the other companies, pull it apart from General Electric? Why are you different? Some of our stuff started to look like Siemens. I'm like, oh my God, it can't look like Siemens. Let's go. We need to start really differentiating ourselves and make a difference. So this is 1999, I got there. It looked and felt like this. Lots of parts. One of the things that's very difficult about this, every one of those product brands was number one or two in their category. They've got boards of directors, their own P&Ls, extraordinary pride in their culture, in their autonomy, et cetera. And guess what? They don't actually want to play with anybody else. The play's nice with other, like Green Sticker, is not good for this group. So in trying to induce them, I always say you have to be a better Pied Piper than a marketing person. There's much more influencing and trying to talk them into the benefits of where you're going to go than it is of just saying, you know, you need to do this because of this brand architecture is a good idea. That's just not going to swing it. So this is the sort of the landscape of what that looked and felt like. This was our logo. And as much as, you know, it's kind of funny to look at it now and think how amazing that is. It never occurred to anybody we'd had logos before. There are actually 13 Emerson logos since 1890. And everyone thought, you know, do you want to change the American flag while you're at it? I was like, oh, my God. It's like, actually, I put this up for our senior management. We have a meeting we call the OCE, which is about 25 of the top executives. And I've only been there, you know, 10 minutes. I've been there about a year. And I put this slide up to show everybody a little thing about maybe it's not the best logo ever. And they say, yay, we won. None of those other guys are in business anymore. And I went, oh, God. I'm like, this is not what I mean. You missed the point. So and as you can see, you know, a lot of these were 20s and 30s kind of look and feel. My CEO liked to say, you can't knock that sucker over. I'm like, well, you can't pick it up either. So it's not exactly the right idea for what we needed. But can I tell you what? It actually perfectly represented the company that stood behind it at the time. It was tough, durable, broad-shouldered, reliable, and you know what? You couldn't knock it over. This was what our advertising looked like. Oh, it's so scary, isn't it? I love to whip this out whenever anybody tries to stick another picture of a component on something and say, and they're like, it's like their children. You know, you guys work in companies like this. This is like pictures of your children. They think they're beautiful. They thought they were cutting edge because there was purpley pink in there. So that was like very, very tough to kind of move people along from that. But as a notion of if you present yourself like a hardware store, how do you get people to think you're a technology leader? How do you get people to think that you are good enough to do innovative solutions? I see nothing about solutions there. And that is the biggest battle I think we run probably for a lot of the people in this room as you try to move forward and upgrade what people think of you, upgrade and kind of make it more interesting who you are, making yourself relevant on more of a personal level so people can have a relationship with your company. So I went through this before. I won't go through this too far, except on a few things. Business school students, I think, come out and think, oh, we're going to have a vision, a mission. Here's our values. Wouldn't this just be perfect? I'm glad you're laughing at that because I understand the pain. I told Chuck Knight we were going to have a vision. He said, why on earth would anybody want something they can't have? Like, obviously, a computer on every desk actually happened. But, you know, it's the kind of things with the great visions for companies which are unattainable out there, stars in the future. He thought that was a ridiculous idea, you know. Why don't we talk about who we are and what we can be in the immediate future kind of thing? So that's what we always call our brand promise. And to me, this became the piece of paper when they could agree to it that made all the difference because it had come together to create solutions for the benefit of our customers. And aside from the fact I actually had customers in there, when we said come together, we started to touch autonomy. I had permission to go at the company, go after the company, and start to help really drive people to work much more closely together. We had parts of the company where the customers would be filling in customer satisfaction surveys, and they'd actually write, if you want me to be more satisfied, stop sending me customer satisfaction surveys. They'd have 7 on their desk at a time. We didn't realize how many of our individual companies were pounding in there trying to get stuff from them. And they could have all sold that stuff together, you know, and really unified it and created a much better sense of reliability and things for our technical products. One of the most important things I think people in this room would probably care about is the very last line, for a world in action. And this comes back to making B2B and industrial companies relevant to the outside world. I think we all get caught up in like the picture of that hardware on the other page and components in what we make when the important thing is what you do and what you do for customers. So we took the annual report from lots of little motor windings and stuff, whipping down conveyor belts with guys in hard hats and safety glasses, to showing children drinking clean water, to showing people putting gas in their car, and trying to move the sensibility of the company toward the end customer and away from what we manufactured. And I was a consultant for a number of years, and I said, I asked somebody if they're going to put something over the front door of their manufacturing plant in Hickory, North Carolina, what would it say? It'd say to employ as many people to manufacture things as possible in our county. And I think that old American manufacturing notion underlies all this of trying to move people to being relevant and getting to be a world in action, supporting things that makes you actually care about what we do. So we changed the logo, and I will tell you the best piece of advice I got in all of this, I always tell all chief marketing officers, like, don't even bring up the logo for 8 months. Sit in your job. I just sit in your office and don't do anything if you have to, but just don't bring it up because they're positive you're going to do it, and they're waiting for you. They know you're coming. They know you're going to mess with the stationery, make you throw out all the business cards, you know, kind of change the colors and do everything. But the most important thing we did was who we tested them with in the long run. So we made it live up to For a World in Action, technology and engineering coming together. It symbolizes all those things. The original logo actually was all in lowercase, which at the time, especially in about 2000, was, you know, click or brick kind of moment in time. You know what? We couldn't live up to that. We weren't a click. We are a fast-moving brick, you know? We could not do that. So, you know, it's one of those things, even though it was maybe a little like shouting to have it all in capital letters, we can live up to that. It is something Emerson could carry, and it made sense. You can never be someone that you can't be, right? So the best thing we did, we tested with shareholders and our customers and our employees. But we went to business school students at the top 10 schools and asked them, can I tell you? It was that's where it came completely apart. That group said, this is a company out in front. They designed, you know, we asked them, what year is this designed in? So it's like in 2001 or something. And they're saying, oh, 2010 kind of thing. We're getting it in front. But those kids are probably 27 years old, really helped define the future of that, because that's who you care about. They're the ones who are going to be really the movers, shakers. They're going to run procurement places. They're going to be head of pricing somewhere. Those are the guys you're going to have to convince along the way. This is our architecture. It's obviously overbranding that we used. And just we didn't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater and get rid of all our divisions. We just had to put them in buckets that made sense. So if I have eight guys, we're big in the process management business where we make all the things go, say, in an oil refinery. So if eight of our guys go in there, their business cards actually look like cousins is a good thing. We got them all the way to the same 10 years later. But this enables you to cross-sell, upsell, do all the things that matter. Now, I have to admit, I thought this was pretty tricky. It was like a wedding cake. So Interbrand did this work with us, and I thought it was almost too complicated for Emerson to understand. We have about 120,000 employees. How do you roll this out and make them see? They just wanted, and I don't blame them, they said, let's just build a bigger Emerson brand. We understand why that would be good. But, you know, let's just keep our individual product names and just be part of Emerson. And it'd be much more of an endorsement kind of strategy in that case. And I said, well, actually, that's how we've been living all these years. It's just such a financially inefficient model down here, like living like Procter & Gamble, when you don't have competitive products. None of our products competed. Why do they need so many different names? It just did not make sense. And the middle, though, is where all the money was. That's where the money is. That's where you're no longer an expert in transmitters. You're an expert in the process industry. You're no longer an expert in air conditioning compressors. You're an expert in the air conditioning industry. So you start to pick your head up and create, as Gary Hamel would say, you know, you gotta create that gray space in between your businesses, and then you can organically grow. We'd always grown through lots and lots of acquisitions, as you can tell, that were like-minded businesses, like a big game of Tetris, but no one had actually sewn them together. So all the money was in the middle, and that's where people had to give up a little of their equity and a little of their control, which is the single hardest thing no one likes to give up, especially if you're a president of a big company within our company. So this is today. This is Dave Farr. He's our CEO. And he is a terrific person to have in the front of this. Everyone laughs, I call him the black lab. He is one of the friendliest, outspoken, oh my God, jump right up in a customer's lap. He is so good, but he is so energetic that he can do this. He can drive us without compromise. He can have the energy to run all those different businesses and pay a lot of attention and put a personable, warm, happy face on the company. That makes my job 400 times easier to have someone like that do that. We're now about $21 billion in sales. As I said, we're living right at that relevancy point, and we've come very well through the recession. We feel we're coming out. And, you know, when we hit this, when we got $20 billion, we're number 94 on the Fortune list now. It just kind of makes a difference. I mean, whether you're doing business in an emerging market where that makes an enormous difference, are you going to be around longer, et cetera? And we're starting to act like a bigger company. A lot of DDB is here today, and Fleischman Hillard, who've done a lot of this work with us. We acted like a small company previously, and I think B2B companies suffer from that. I think, I don't know if we have an inferiority complex next to the, you know, Nike's Titleists of the world, but, you know, we're big. We actually make the world go as a group of companies. We talked about dinner last night. It's important how we look and act to the world economy. We actually set the tone. We set the optimistic tone or not, has been previously the case. So very important as we try to act like a bigger company. We are financially very successful, and we have a very long history of reliability. That original logo was correct in that. It maybe wasn't enough to get us up that last little spike without changing how we do business. So this is a little more how those eight businesses play out now. We still have things that are number one and two in the category in all of our businesses, whether it's garbage disposals, crash carts for hospitals. Three biggest businesses are climate technologies, where we do refrigeration in grocery stores. All the high-end air conditioning in your homes has probably got a Copeland scroll in our controllers. Things like process management, everything in number one in the world in oil and gas and chemical, petrochem, all the things that make those work. And in network power, that's data centers, data infrastructure equipment, backup power for the New York Stock Exchange and things like that. So this is for making us relevant, keeping the world running kind of mentality. So the media starts to notice at that point. I think from the day I started till now, we've quintupled probably our PR business with Fleischman. Big difference. As I said, I've got a terrific CEO to turn out on that. He's extremely outspoken, so we're careful when times are tough. He will tell the truth. Our analysts adore him and our CFO because we're very transparent. We're actually extremely good at sharing what that is. So sometimes we kind of shut the door and say, no, we're not answering any more questions because we keep answering the questions. So as chief marketing officer, I'm like, he's sitting down now. Yeah. So, but he's been a terrific person in the front. We've made a slow, steady climb on our Fortune Most Admired, and that is something I actually would say, how do you move up on it? Work at it. You know, market it. We do mailings to all the people on the list. I learned that, I don't know if anyone hears from Siemens. I learned it from Siemens. They suddenly climbed way up there one year, so I asked them, I said, how'd you do that? They go, oh, we started marketing to all those guys. We actually picked the people who answered the questions, which you're allowed to do in your firm. There's a lot you can do to help yourself do this better. So, you know, it's one of those things, if your packaging looks bad, it's because you forgot to get around to it, right? If you're doing really poorly in here, there's probably something you can do that will really help you score better. It's kind of like U.S. News and World Report on the colleges. They work very hard at getting higher on those. So what are we doing? And what's the, you know, if I'd say, what are the slides that you want to rip off or some of the ones in this part to take back to your organization and start to fix some things? And one of the things as we work on being differentiated, it is absolutely dead clear that we have to get in solutions. It is the place for us to go. And everyone says, oh my God, solutions is so overused, it's so terrible, it doesn't mean anything. Everyone's lying when they say them, it just means you're selling a bunch of components anyway to people. And that's not the case. I'd say, actually, there's so much you can do to sew it together, but as a corporation and probably a regular American manufacturing company, you've got a history of manufacturing, not of sewing things together where a customer is telling you what they need kind of thing. And we have globalization is like great and terrible at the same time. It's great because of all the opportunity, right? But how about your competition and your price pressure now? Your customers can buy anything around the world 10 minutes later, comparable quality, half the cost kind of thing. So we're under this extraordinary duress on pricing and on competition for great products. You've got to find a way to build more value in there. And a lot of the time it's taking unique pieces and putting them together where no one can do it the same way you can, whether you put in your corporate personality to wrap it together and offer incredible service, quick delivery, great communication, or you simply make some better products that work together in an unusual way. So you have a lot of ways to solve those customers, and I will tell you the single hardest thing is changing your culture of your business to even appreciate these things, much less act on them and do something better. This is from Keith Eads and Robert Keir. They wrote some of the great sales performance books. We use them for some training, and IBM has used them for a lot of their training. And just sort of, I actually showed this to our board of directors this week, of trying to explain how we have lived on this left-hand side where the yellow is. We have lived with an insular view. We have lived with owning our position in a category as compared with our customer's sunburn. It's so much easier to segment those customers by their problems and then deliver segmented products, right? Targeted products to them, than trying to manufacture things one at a time. For Emerson, this is terribly important because this is the lever to success for us and for anybody else that has lots of parts to your company. It is this notion of being two-dimensional versus multidimensional. We have more companies per category than anybody else, say in the process industry, whether it's instrumentation, that's all the pieces and parts, or software at the high end of the scale. And we're deep in those. Those companies were one or two in those categories to begin with all by themselves, right? It's the knitting together of them, that multidimensional thing, where the leverage is. We have been a really successful company in this first category, like everybody has. Your IT systems were set up to count these one at a time, every one of those products. Every system you have in your company, everything, like a 1950s mentality, one thing at a time. ERP is going to add you up one at a time. My market share is X. We don't actually have market share on pain categories. So you're inventing tomorrow as you're doing this, but it's going to thrill your customers. Loyalty is what? Based on delight. You're going to delight them when you actually leverage the great pieces you have. You're not going to delight them here. The single greatest gift every marketing person can give a salesperson is situational fluency. You go out and you find what is best-in-class behavior of their competitors, even in the category, in your industry, and you teach them. It is the greatest gift you have. And when you teach them, the answer is all within your company, all the things you can help them with. And they call it commercial teaching. So this is from the Sales Executive Council, and some of this is with actually from Keith and Robert. But one of the things, and it was kind of fun to talk, I used this with the board this week. You know, you used to walk in and say, what keeps you up at night? We all thought that was sort of, aren't we cutting edge? We're actually asking. That was a long way for an industrial sales guy. They're all engineers to try to get anyways, you know. And then we got to leads with a hypothesis. Yeah, I know you're feeling the pinch too. You know, there's your hypothesis. How about you go in with insight of other people in your business are able to do this more efficiently, faster, and less expensively with wireless, with X, with Y. And you go in and teach them something about, that's a great way to do that, you know. Commercial teaching, don't lead with information about yourself. I got 1,000 sales guys calling for annual reports. I'm like, who starts a sales conversation with annual report? I don't know about you guys. I don't write them for our customers. We write them for the investment community. And you're talking about how much money you make off your customers. It is exactly the wrong thing to hand to a customer. It's just the wrong thing. And I was laughing because I was with our Latin American president was there. And he goes, Kathy, I always like to give those. And I'm like, well, you're going to stop giving them because it's the wrong thing. But I know why they do it. It's for credibility. So you need to give them something else to back that up because it is wrong. But the thing you really do, don't just tell them about why you have great products. That's the wrong place to start. Tell them a story about their business. And this is up to marketing. This is our job, everyone in here. And it's a hard job. Give them a story about the business and about the customer's problem and then answer it. Solve their problems. We are doing all these big pain-to-solutions maps of saying, for guys in the olefins business, they have furnaces that get clogged up. Here's a story about, I bet you lose a lot of downtime based on that. You know what we found some of the other people in your business are doing? Here's the answer. And it's really, this is where marketing plays. Define the pain. It's up to the sales guy to find the power. You need the power guy. We give them the solution vision and what the value is. And you have to crisply articulate that for the sales guy. Write it down. Give them a script. Teach them how to do it well. So when they get in there, they end up having what we call situational fluency. And they are flexible. They can have a dialogue. And they can really help their customers. I'm going to do the right side first because I'm talking about that. The Sales Executive Council, the Corporate Executive Board, this is my favorite piece of research they did on what kind of salesperson is successful in that environment. And they call him the challenger. And this person is someone who teaches, tailors, and asserts control. And they crush the guy who's the relationship builder. And most of us have companies built out of relationship builders. Worst thing about those guys is they like to agree with the customer. So they don't change their mind, and they sell too soon. If the customer says, I want 4 transmitters, he's like, oh, excellent. They want 4, you know, whatever the RFP says, here you go. Well, guess what? The guy maybe wants to reconsider a whole part of his company. You know, there's something bigger that hasn't even been out there yet. You need a sales guy that can challenge that and say, well, you know, I know you think that's what you're going to want in here, but I actually think what you'll see other people in your business are doing is XYZ. This person is good. He's comfortable discussing money. He's comfortable discussing value and the business issues that customer faces, and he can actually disagree with the customer. He has to take him somewhere new. And I would say you take that piece of paper and you walk into your HR office and say, these are the people I want to work with as a marketing person so we can be more successful. And this is how we're training. Liz and I just went all over the world, as you can see. We trained about 450 marketing and salespeople together on doing this. And, you know, those silos are just as hard for us between marketing and sales as they are between those individual divisions. Trying to get them to listen to each other, trying to say, it's marketing's job to go get that information and help you with it. So that marketing's not, I don't know about you guys, sometimes the sales force, like, we do marketing to them. You open a sales guy's desk, there's 40 DVDs in there that they've never looked at. Yep, there's another one. You know, I wish they just want brochures. Give me a brochure. It gives me the answers kind of thing. On this side, on the marketing capabilities that drive, look how strong this is. This is from the Marketing Leadership Council. The thing that drives loyalty, learn, teach, amplify. As we come under more and more financial pressure, we all live in a world of consensus selling, right? Most of the things we sell are too expensive for one person to sign off on. It takes maybe 10, 30 people to agree inside an industrial company on buying something. Under financial duress, that doubles, triples. It's safe not to make an answer, right? It's safe not to say yes. It's safe to postpone. I'm not going to get fired if I don't buy it right now. We're all sitting on budgets as tight as they ever get right now, I bet. And it's so easy not to make a decision. So one of the things you have to do, we go out and learn marketing, right? We go learn what's the best behavior in the industry, what your customer needs. We go in and teach, don't just sell or serve. And then what you have to do is amplify. So you're teaching your advocate inside the company, and then you give him the tools to teach everybody else. You can't sell to all 40 of those people. You'll never get in there. Your sales guy needs help. So marketing's got to give him the tools to amplify it when you're not standing there. So he's a hero. He's got all the answers. And look at this. Isn't this a great idea? I mean, that's what you want him to walk down the hallway and do. So how do we show that we're, you know, that's great. We're doing all this inside the company. How do we show the outside world? How do we behave more like a company that doesn't sell those components and hardware? And how do we show the outside world that we can do solutions? Why is Emerson different? What is it we do? So DDB actually worked on this campaign for us, and it's never been done before. That's got a bunch of different things. We went in, and I would tell you this is one of the best things we did internally in the company, and did matrices that showed minor revisions, major revisions, new to the business, new to the world, on an axis, and showed what we were finding. We were doing a lot of cost reducing, minor revisions to products to take cost out. We weren't necessarily innovating them up. And this has got so much wind in our sails now. Every single planning conference we do, our big meetings with our businesses now, you see that flush of thinking and innovation and movement out to those other quadrants now. I think one of the great things you tend to find in your own company is the things that catch fire inside very often sometimes set fire outside too. So I took that interest and that excitement inside the company and said, let's turn that outside. And let's turn our outside voice to be, well, let's talk about new to the business, new to the world. Let's talk about things no one's ever done before, because all of them will be solutions. They aren't going to be component answers. And it actually was an interesting timing, because we're right in the teeth of the recession, right in the worst part last spring. And one of the things I thought, we did two things, and my whole creative team's here, is I gave them the nano chromatic ads that had just been done for shuffles and iPods and things. And they had that ink or the paint just dripping down the side. I saw it first in New York on the side of a building. I was so in love with it. And I was like, I want our TV and everything to feel like that looks, that color and that feeling, that vivaciousness. And we do a lot of advertising in CNBC domestically. And, you know, it was a doom and gloom. Who wants to look? And, you know, the Money Honey suddenly had a whole new nickname from everybody that was not nice. And they're like, because, and you know what? Everyone loved her during the bull market. She was hot. She was the honey. She's no longer the honey when the market's going crashing every day. And I thought one of the things, Emerson, because they're relevant, they're over $20 billion, we're 94, it's our job to act different in the marketplace. It's our job to start to change how people think about business, period. How about we look optimistic? How about we try to put a happy face on CNBC? How about we put a happy face on a place like CNN International and internationally and in China and all over the world of saying, we're fine. We're going to be fine, and we're going to help our customers be fine and innovate out of trouble and actually make it, I literally call it the optimistic face of global business. And we launched it in 9 languages around the world, which, is, as Liz will say, is the most awful experience there is translating things into 9 languages around the world. Oh, my God. It is not pleasant. So we've somehow survived it to go on with a print and television campaign. These are our new ads that we just did this week. Now, just so you know, and I know a lot of you probably have very large ad budgets, we only spent, and I'll use Siemens Global, our corporate number of last year's, over $100 million in the U.S. I think you all know General Electric, I think, spent $120 million when they launched Echo Imagination. We spend about $10 to $15 million a year globally. So I'm probably coming back towards some of your budgets, towards some of the realities of what we spend that started around you know, just $2 million when we started and kind of started to pick up the speed and spend a little more. Now we're spending a lot. We're not spending as much in traditional markets, not in Western Europe and U.S. as much, a lot in the Middle East, heavy in China, doing a lot more in Latin America, especially in Brazil. So you got to follow the world where the growth is, and I could advertise my brains out last spring in the U.S. We weren't going to sell more transmitters because I put an ad in LaGuardia Airport. You know, it just wasn't a good use of money. So we've really diversified our strategy. I'm thrilled with it. We're doing a lot of things with the Wall Street Journal. I actually even like what we're doing on television, some stuff with the Golf Channel, cheaper than, you know, CBS and the networks kind of things, Wi-Fi, and we're doing a much better job internationally language-wise. And I empathize, and I'm happy to hear anybody's global strategies on how you deal that. I think it's the hardest thing we have to do. We have so many businesses and so many languages. So I'm going to show you, end with a quick video. I wouldn't be a good marketing person if I didn't bring eye candy, so that's my job. And before I say it, I will thank DDB for the unbelievable creative work they've done this year for us and last year for the last 10 years. I have the exact same creative team for 11 years. And I'll tell you, that is a rare and exciting thing to have. They actually put the video together. But it shows, even in the teeth of recession, how much joy and positive things can go on. All three of our TV commercials are in there as well. So go ahead.
Scream out loud if you want anyone to hear you. If you want anyone to listen. If you want to change the world.
When a stock gets hit with just about the worst news possible, ultimate 2x4 smacked around the head and the abdomen, and it doesn't budge, that's how you know you got a winner on your hands.
We are finally starting to emerge from one of the most challenging economic time periods we've experienced in over 50 years. Every Emerson business around the world has been affected one way or another, and some very significantly. As we undertook the necessary restructuring and retrenching, Emerson also did what we do best. We kept innovating and developing new products for our future prosperity. I want to thank all the Emerson employees for their dedication, hard work, and commitment to make Emerson the best of the best.
Whoa! Whoa! These are the stocks that we think about in recovery. Emerson, Emerson, Emerson.
Emerson's new numbers are actually better than expected.
I am telling you that these kinds of nuclear hardened stocks make terrific buys. There's another reason I like Emerson, too. It's one of our high yields. You know, the notoriously B-I-G juicy 6.3% yield.
A company with a good track record and also, importantly, a realistic outlook on the demand front is Emerson Electric.
We have some exposure to cyclicals in what we call quality global industrials, companies like Emerson.
Listen up. Here's the deal. I wanna break down all the walls. I wanna open up the conversation lines. Scream out loud if you wanna change the world.
The long-term growth strategies and best-cost global positioning we had in place before the downturn have put us further along the path of recovery than most companies. Equally as important to the company, we have strengthened our balance sheet even with these tough economic times. We have kept our primary focus on our core businesses and looked ahead to where we believe the market growth is currently the strongest. Infrastructure growth in the developing world, primary and renewable power generation and distribution, enhancing energy efficiency, network integrity and data center infrastructure. So that as we move into 2010, we are able to grow once again.
Somebody listen to change somebody's mind.
Владимир Путин нажал символическую кнопку, которая дала.
With heating, ventilating, and air conditioning sectors starting to improve, Emerson, a name we've talked about in China Watch before, is up.
The long-term story is still very strong for Emerson. It's the best in the industry, the most diversified, highest technology-based products. They have 30% of their exposure in emerging markets, 9% in China. So I think there's enough for them to grow when the overall macro economy improves, not only in the U.S., but also overseas.
I'm just like you. You're just like me.
We invest in people and in process, in facilities.
Innovation hubs, design centers, connect and solve.
Ease of use center of excellence.
Sparing no effort
to deliver at breakneck speed.
Better scream out loud!
Here is a big boost for the local economy. St. Louis-based Emerson Electric opened its new $50 million data center today in Ferguson. The 35,000-square-foot facility will be about one-third more energy efficient than traditional data centers.
This investment here will return dividends for Emerson quickly and help get our state economy moving in the right direction as well. This data center is also an example of a major corporation making the decision to go green, to employ the latest in solar technologies to help power the building and its equipment.
I'm just like you. You're just like me. You're just like me. You're just like me. If you want to change the world.
I'm here today with Al Novak of Emerson Process Management, and we're going to talk about alternative energy.
Whoa! Scream out loud if you want anyone to hear you. If you want anyone to listen. If you want to change the world.
Help transform leftover wood waste, chips, and bark into a viable gasoline substitute on a truly commercial scale? When Emerson takes up the challenge, it's never been done before, simply becomes, consider it solved. Emerson.
Loire-Sommer is on hand to help you identify potential energy savings in your installations by suggesting high-performance solutions that match your requirements.
To be the voice of reason, to make somebody listen, to change somebody's mind. It's how it's supposed to be. It's how I'm supposed to be. I'm just like you. You're just like me. You're just like me. You're just like me.
Northern China reduces its reliance on coal-fired heating plants and prevents 60 million tons of CO2 emissions? When Emerson takes up the challenge, it's never been done before, simply becomes, consider it solved. Emerson.
Rather than just push paper around to the government and back again, these guys actually make things!
If you want another measure of their success, Rigid now makes over 3,000 tools that are sold in 140 countries around the world.
This Sea Snake micro inspection camera from Rigid gives you eyes to see anything that lies in a hard to reach, obstructed, or tight space.
You're just like me! You're just like me!
They make the InSinkErator garbage disposal.
InSinkErator claims that their Evolution Series disposals will grind better and quieter than your old unit ever did.
How does it do with bones?
We can do bones.
Virtually any kind of food waste into an unending source of electrical power for a city? When Emerson takes up the challenge, it's never been done before, simply becomes, consider it solved. Emerson.
Yes, it's been a long, challenging, and tough last 18 months, but we remain financially strong and healthy. And we are still creating the new to the business and new to the world products and solutions, which are our future, proving to our customers and to the world that when Emerson takes up the challenge, it's never been done before, simply becomes, consider it solved.
Emerson is a powerful force for innovation. That's why when Emerson takes up customer challenges, it's never been done before, simply becomes, consider it solved.
If you want to change the world, you better scream out loud to be the voice of reason, to make somebody listen, to change somebody's mind.
I told you I had a friendly CEO. I'm going to tell you guys one of the great lessons of life that every single person probably hears sooner or later has to shoot their chief executive officer or senior executives for videos. Always get, you know, I think what we all try to do, it'll only take 5 minutes. I swear to God, it'll only take 5 minutes. It's the single worst sentence you can make. And I can tell you the lesson learned, and I have one piece that Dave's, there's a lot longer piece that Dave is in. And we actually take 4 hours to shoot, say that much. And ask him for 4 times more than you need, give him the gift of time and give it back if you didn't need all of it. But the truly great performances we have gotten, and Marcia, we also find out who they like. And Marcia's our chief creative director. He loves her. So she can make him relax and smile. She can tell him that he's being stiff or stupid or nasty or scary or sexy or whatever he's being. And say, we always say, put scary Dave away and bring out sexy Dave. We want to see the other one, you know? Because sometimes that's the only time your employees will ever see that human being or that man is on that piece of video. So you got to make sure he is exactly what you want and what he wants to be. He's proud to look good. He's proud to look like that. You know, I go look, IT or someone will shoot one for 30 seconds with him, and he looks like some stuffed shirt. You got to give people time to relax and time to do it again. The best thing we did with 7 executives a few years ago, we shot him once, and then we did had him do it all over again 2 weeks later, or a week later, I guess we did it. But you know what? They were perfect the second time. They were terrible the first time. And we actually made it competitive a little bit for them. We showed one of them and did a really great job and said, no, you need to do it as well as he did. And they're like, oh, my God. So they all perform much better. But just a little advice to take on the road, I think. Finally, we actually won a creative award. And I put this up here partly to say, you know, in the industrial world, I think we don't even think about this a lot of the time. And never, you know, I don't necessarily fill out the Effie Awards and all these different things and kind of let them go. And can I tell you something? It was a great moment to be able to show our board of directors, which, you know, this company had a zero ad budget once upon a time in recent history, that, oh my gosh, because you had courage and because our CEO is willing to sign off on the television commercials that no one ever would have believed could come out of Emerson's front door. I mean, it's impossible that we were able to push the envelope that far out. Those are all our alternative rock bands from around the world on there. All computer-generated visuals and stuff. I'm really proud that our company was willing to go there. And you know what? If we're trying to differentiate ourselves, we should look, smell, taste, and feel really different than other companies do. So with that, that's finished. And if you have any questions, I'm sure I'm going to do it.
Kathy, that was terrific as always, and so insightful. We have time for a few questions, and there are people that are walking, I think, with microphones if anyone wants to raise their hand if there are some questions within the audience. And here we go.
Kathy, hi. Mike Griffin with the Wall Street Journal.
Are you a journalist or an advertising person?
I'm an advertising.
Okay, just checking.
Don't worry.
please don't put the sexy Dave part in the article. Or the scary one, for that matter.
One question I have, the thing that's been impressive about Emerson, is your commitment to this strategy over time. Can you speak to that? So often you hear about three-year plans that become one-year plans or five-year plans that become two-year plans.
Well, a couple things. One is, you know, I did tell you about being a Pied Piper is more important than being, you know, a great marketing person. One of the things that is revered at our company is sticking to the plan. And we have what we call the discipline management process that underlies everything we do. I think it makes it a lot easier for everybody to believe it, for one thing, if you stick to it. These are very skeptical, cynical engineers. And as a matter of fact, a lot of them, you know, have very little interest in a lot of what is going on until they walk through an airport with their husband or wife and see one of those, and their kid says, hey, isn't that where you work, kind of moments. And all of a sudden, they decide it's not such a bad thing or bad use of money. I think for an industrial company that never spent money on things as frivolous as advertising, I think it is very scary. Their notion is it is going to change all the time. It's kind of like the stationary change originally, I think. It feels frivolous if it changes, I think. And one of the hardest things, as I said a little bit on all those parts, it takes years to get all those people actually on that machinery going forward. And, you know, if I changed, I just barely got some people using the same PowerPoint templates, you know, 3 years ago. You think, it's like impossible, you know, finally get the business cards all right. I couldn't stand to change that. I would die, you know. So probably, if anything, one of the hardest things is for us to reconsider things outside of that box. Because, I break my own rules sometimes. I have a really good example. You can see our logo. I've always said you may not take the logo off the words, right? Absolutely not, absolutely not, absolutely not. Nobody can do that. Well, I went and talked to, what's the name of the company? Vineyard Vines, to do ties, silk ties for Emerson. Well, I'm not going to put Emerson with a logo. It looks really pretty with all the logos, right? So I'm like, oh, just do it. So he did it. Oh, my God, my brand office. I didn't ask permission, of course. I just did it. And I was saying it was a fashion choice. I think those are exceptions to the rule. But, you know, I get push on those kind of things. So actually, the more I keep to my own rules and the more we stay to our knitting, the more the company can embrace it. And I think in engineering, it really makes them comfortable to understand where those boundaries are. So changing them really rocks the boat.
Do we have
Kathy, can you talk about metrics? Can you talk about what the CEO and the executive team really looked at in terms of evaluating the performance of the marketing effort?
Yeah, I think probably I sit under the least difficult hard metrics. One of the things that's interesting, and it's funny because I'm not really a big proponent of the Fortune numbers that are up there, because as I said, I think we all kind of, I hate to tell you this, any of you that are in our category, I don't exactly give you sevens, you know? I give you ones. If I'm competing at you, I'm going to give you 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, and Emerson 10, or whatever the scale was. I forget what it is. But it's funny, the whole reason I think I work at Emerson is partly because of Fortune Magazine's Most Admired, because Emerson was doing really well on some of the categories and did poorly in technology, believe it or not. And it's because we weren't getting credit on the Emerson brand. Copeland or Liebert or InSinkErator or someone all got their credit, and no one knew we made all that stuff. Probably all the people in this room didn't know that. And it made them crazy. We were spending $500-600 million a year in R&D and getting no credit for it. So one of the things that really helped was actually even the Fortune magazine thing of being able to move it. And in our industry, and I think probably anybody else who's in a technical business, your leadership numbers depend on your technology numbers, because that is what people attribute greatness to, kind of thing. So we use that, which we use third-party things. We do a very elaborate brand study every 2 years that is very deep. I end up with a book about this thick on our customers. It's very hard to actually do, I would tell you. We do it with Harris. And that is probably the most important thing we use. You know, I can give them like our advertising metrics, things are click-through rates and some of those things. They don't care about that. That's irrelevant. Speaking of being relevant, that's irrelevant to our senior executives' understanding about success of things. That video is probably one of the most powerful things I can show them. keeping us relevant, making us relevant in the public eye is really my job. You know, you see the divisions work. You can see the platform stuff in there as well. It's up to them to help promote wireless, and I help them do those kind of things. But it's my job to get that big face, that big face. And that tends to be rather obvious if you're being successful or not and the quality of how that goes. So I would honestly say that video is probably one of the most important things. We call it the sizzle video every year that I put in front of the company because they aren't all going to see all that. You know, they don't know it all happens. So
we have a question in the back if we can get a microphone to him. And Kathy, as you talked about the progress that you made, you went from sort of arriving and then differentiating. Was it when you started at that point, were you trying to arrive before differentiate? Because sometimes I think there's that challenge of we have to differentiate ourselves and companies really haven't arrived.
I actually do think, and you know what, I'd rather be lucky than smart, but we have a little joke in our inside team is time is your friend. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things I see young executives suffer from is being in too much of a hurry and trying to get to the end thing. And again, this is sort of a business school piece of advice I always give all the students, is go slower. Corporations don't move fast. They can get up to about a trot, but that's only if they really like what they see. And maybe you can get the Queen Mary to swing the bow around faster, but it doesn't move fast. So even the company itself, I would say the company has to catch up. I can move the outside world fast. The outside world's happy to see those new ads. Woo, that's fun. That's good. It makes perfect sense. They don't realize that, you know, we're down in St. Louis, Missouri, grinding it out every day. You know, they think we actually are like that. So the thing is trying to move the company at a speed that it can cope with. So I think the company had to arrive and sort of notice, oh, my God, people are noticing us. People, I don't have to explain where I work anymore. The person when I tell them on the airplane, you know, understands where I'm working. And then you can start to get kind of fancy, I guess I'd say, or you can start to elaborate a little bit. You get the credibility to stretch is probably the big thing.
Okay, Lynn?
Hi. I loved your presentation a few years ago, so it's thrilling to have you back.
Oh, thank you.
I'd like to ask you a question in terms of how you use your marketing staff's power on individual company levels and then corporate-wide. How do you achieve synergies so that they're not all competing against each other, putting together the central brand message, and how they can all be successful for their individual companies from a marketing staffing perspective?
That's actually a really good question. It's sort of like a Mary Kay deal. Okay, no pink Cadillacs, but it's in a lot of what we do. I have a very small staff. There's literally in my sort of immediate staff, there's like five of us, and I actually have, believe it or not, teams in Xi'an, China, and in Manila that we do market research out of in language. So we can do Chinese out of Xi'an, low cost, 20 universities in a small space. You know, I can hire people from AC Nielsen or whatever to do market research, qualitative and quantitative work for us. So we have staffs that are kind of far flung that way. I do not have 45. I've had bigger marketing staffs. I worked at Converse. I think we had five times as many people for a $300 million company. You know, so we are lean and mean. First of all, the way we get all of this done is one of the greatest things Emerson afforded me was to use the best help in the world. So for a company with zero marketing budget to use all the Omnicom companies, because I use DDB, Fleischmann, Hillard, we used Interbrand, and we've used a couple other companies under that bridge. I try to use that. That is my staff. That's my big staff to get the absolutely, like we're going to spend $300 million in advertising, not 12. So when you get great creative work, and we do the same thing in our public relations, then it looks like you're spending a lot more money. I let that creative work very, very hard for us to look different and do stuff. I think a huge mistake, and my divisions do it all the time, is they hire someone who's down the block that does two-bit junk, you know, and gives them their brand strategy. You know, no offense to anyone as a designer, but I don't necessarily want my design guy writing my strategy. You know, so you start accepting stuff that's not as good because you're afraid to spend enough money. We spent a lot of money on the upfront, a lot of money on that, so I have things that people love. And, you know, one of the things in all of the companies I think we all work for in here is our employees aren't spoiled by color and sound and movie stars and stuff like consumer products companies are. I bring color, sound, T-shirts with bright colors on them. We're superstars, you know. It's easy. Music, rock music, woo! I mean, they think it's like we invented music, you know. And I always say I have the best job in the company because I bring light, sound, and joy, you know, when you come in and you do stuff. It's more fun than talking about tax and, you know, how's your POR and sort of the dour side. So one of the biggest things you have to have is the joy of what that is as you sort of bring it. So they want it. And then we create like a Mary Kay structure. So I have 8 brand officers, 1 for each of those. And then we have people in each major world area that do the same thing. And then I can have a brand officer meeting. Those. What I tend to do is set the rules, set the stuff. We have field books, what we call strategy, public relations, and naming. Which, by the way, naming, we could do a whole 2 hours on naming. We found guys in Latin America naming products after their old girlfriends. Some of them were interesting, yeah. So, you know, it's one of those funny things of saying, you got to give them rules, and then print them, publish them, give them out, and try to enforce them. And every once in a while, I'll do a business card search. I'll do like an audit of a world area, something, and say, I want to see everyone's business cards. You know, in China, they go to like Kinko's or the thing and like Xerox their business cards, practically. And we have really strict rules on the paper and all this stuff, trying to keep it together. So we try to do that on those things. But we do it on a lean, mean group of people, on almost a volunteer staff. Those people have real jobs. They're vice presidents of marketing in a platform, like our guy who's vice president of marketing in Syncorator is a brand officer for us, kind of thing. So it's a volunteer army. It's a miracle it works. I just honestly tell you that. So,
well, it's impressive what this army has put together and what you have led. And we thank you so much for joining us. Give a round of applause to Kathy. And as a very small token of our appreciation,
I don't know
when you have downtime, and she's certainly a dynamo, but we thought a little relaxation in spa would be nice.
Oh, I'm very good at that, so thank
and
you.
That's good for St. Louis or Chicago.
Oh, good.
So come back
thank
and visit you. Either way.
Thanks.
Thank you very much,
Kathy. Thank you.
So we have just a couple of items of business, most importantly, Suzanne's NFL football. And I think the team has come up and is ready for the raffle. Do we know who's picking the lucky number? Oh, I am. Mm-hmm. Okay. The number is 599-344. Oh, so close. Do we still have the winner here? Oh, in the towards the back of the room. Suzanne, so come up and see one of these women, and Suzanne Martin will be getting your football to you. Congratulations. So we thank you all. We invite you to join us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and in our breakfast roundtable on the 17th with Google, and next month here with Career Builder, who will be launching their Super Bowl story and many other parts of their B2B strategy. Many thanks to everyone.